That is a letter O, is it? What will it do for one? Well, it's going to stand for the word all. How do you spell all? Any offers? Do you know that word is a legitimate word? Do you know that is actually a quite legitimate spelling for all? Maybe you prefer it this way. What word is that? Yes? If we was to put a dot in there, like that, can you see the dot? You could spell whirl with W-H-I-R-L, couldn't you? Now the difference between whirl with an O and whirl with an I is that whirl with an O represents the totality of all being, but with an I represents the totality of individuated being. So if you care to make a note of that, save me wasting my pen and drying up sooner than later. You can write whirl with an I and whirl with an O and think whirl with an O is all there is, all that's conceivable. No matter how intelligent we may become, it is all included in that word. Now, this all has to be analyzed by us because we are said to be in a fallen state. We've fallen from wholeness into partiality, where partiality signifies preference for one thing rather than another. We might have all for our preference, but partiality doesn't want all. It wants the bit that it sees. It doesn't want the ugly maiden and the bow-legged man. It wants the beautiful maiden and the somewhat long-legged heroic type of midnight movie fellow who solves all problems. I think his name is Roger Moore. Now, we're going to analyze the all, and in order to do so, we have to cut the all in half like that. When we analyze, we cut things conceptually into bits. When I put that line there, it signifies we are not going to talk about the whole as whole, but we're going to talk about the whole as parted within itself. So I now have a part below and a part above this middle line. Observe, I have not destroyed the circle, so the wholeness itself is not cut. But we are talking about it as if we were able to cut it. Now, in fact, we cannot cut ultimate reality. We can talk as if we can, but we can't actually cut it. We haven't got the power to do so, because ultimate reality is a continuum of power. And the continuum cannot be made discontinuous, because it has no parts. But the part is an intellectual exercise that we do to clarify to ourselves. And when we look at reality, we find some of it we know about already, or think we do, and some of it we know we don't know. So I'm going to shade the bottom part here, like this. And that makes the bottom part dark. Now the dark part is the part we don't know about. And the light part above there is the part that we do know about. And we're going to call the part down here the dark world, and the part above it the light world. And by dark, we mean the will. Will is dark. But idea is light. And I'm going to put in the top intellect. There. Is that readable? Does that look like intellect? What? Intellect. The tea has got inside the sea and made into neat. I imagine that the gentleman that said that must belong to the elite. Could be, to be able to see that. Intellect implies a locking up process. Now, in the intellect we have forms. I'll do a little circle to represent a form, another one, and another one, to represent a relationship of forms. Now the word form is a Latin word, forma, which translates the Anglo term shape, and the Greek word idea. Idea means a definable. Form means a definable. Shape means a definable. And the way we define is by tying a line around the thing. If we can get a cord and put it right round and tie it, and it holds on to that thing is definable by the cord we put round it. Define means indicate the limit of. So the intellect is concerned with definable forms or ideas. But the will itself is not so definable. Now we tend to think, and therefore to be intellectual, that is to have ideas, and we tend to think that when we know something intellectually, we are enlightened and somehow superior to those who are not enlightened and are dark. But in the darkness there of the most ignorant living person, in that darkness there is a will to subsist, there is a will to live, and the intellect cannot analyze the will. The will is not analyzable. No matter how much you apply the intellect to the will, it will not tell you anything about it other than will is that which interferes with the intellect. So we've now taken the all and we have cut it into two conceptually. This cutting into two is an intellectual act. It has not cut the will. Our will remains exactly what it was before analysis, after we've completed the analysis. Now we want to say, from the individual center here, can we simultaneously see intellectually and will non-intellectually? If we can, we have completed our evolution. And we want to represent this in the diagram. We want to say somewhere at the interface of will and intellect, there is a point of individuation in which a conscious individual can become aware of its own will and its own intellect and can see how the will has given rise to the intellect. That is how the forms, the ideas, are actually made by acts of will. There are no ideas that are not wills to form. We want to represent this in the drawing. Now, in principle, I should draw at right angles upwards like this, a line coming out, but if I draw it this way and then take away the pen, you don't see anything up there, do you? No. So I'll draw it like this instead. There is the line. Now, that line that I've drawn represents the transcendence of the opposition of intellect and will. It represents a marvelous power that a human being has, not an animal, not a vegetable, not a mineral, a human being has, of actually coming to grips with his own intellect, his own will, and although the will can never be formulated intellectually, the individual can become aware of the will in the individual to make an intellectual formulation. And when he makes that formulation, we are going to pin, nail, or crucify this form of the intellect on this will, and this will on this form. And so we draw a line across there. We have now drawn the orb, which you see in the hands of all the best ruling bodies in the world. Now look at that very carefully, because this is a drawing of a human being. The dark part down there is the subdiaphragm. It's everything below your diaphragm, and it has to do with unconscious forces of the will that are not intellectually formulable. No amount of thinking about the will tell you what the will is. You can feel the will start its initiative process. You can feel the aftermotion of the will as desire, but you cannot actually feel the will. Remember our demonstration, when you bend the finger, when you make the decision to bend it, you can't feel any energy expenditure, but you can feel your intention to bend your finger. Bend the finger, and before you bend it, feel your intent. Now, when you feel that intention to bend, what you're feeling there is your will. But you can't define it. You can define what it intends to do, namely, bend the finger. But you can't define the will itself. The will is called the great mystery. All the mystics talk incessantly about the same thing, the mystery of the will. Now, the will arises from the dark part here. And inside this circle, all the forces of the will and the intellect weave together. And there's a Greek word for weaving, substance or fabric, bisos. And there is a privative alpha before that word, and it gives us the word abyss. That means not woven. Not bis, not woven. And it also means the father of generative power affirms the separation into two worlds, two S's. One is the world of will, and the other is the world of intellectual forms or ideas. Now the problem is, remember this line is coming up at right angles, is to raise a standard of consciousness above the level of dark will, lift the dark will, the so-called unconscious of the psychologist, lift the dark will up until you permeate it with consciousness so that you know what is inside your dark will. And at the same time, you clearly formulate the intentions hidden in the dark will, because the intellect is nothing but a product of the dark will's intentions. You have as many clearly formulated ideas as you have motivations, that is, dark wills. The abyss, the unwoven, is beyond this circle, beyond all definition. The abyss is, in religion, called God the Father. It is the power that by self-encapsulation, that is by surrounding itself with a whirl, by self-encapsulation makes itself into a being. The word being is based on that be, and be, originally a circle, means a dwelling or zone of encapsulation. You are bounded by your skin surface, and that skin surface is your integument. The possibility of your integrity, the possibility of your integration. The skin allows you to work inside your body to develop your own intelligence, and in so doing to become the master of yourself, your destiny, your fate, or whatever. You become self-determined by self-encapsulation. The abyss gives rise to the dark will to initiate a process of existence. Existence means standing outness. This circle stands out from the background. This background is light. The light is fairly even. It's an equable light before creation. In other words, the ultimate before creation is an equable consciousness permeated with will throughout, and the will and the consciousness are absolutely in total agreement with each other, and it makes an equable light. But when we surround a zone of this equable light, we encapsulate the zone, and in so doing we cause relative darkness. And you see, the darknesses are two kinds. One kind, the darkness of the will, which is not definable, and the other is the darkness of the idea. Remember, from infinity comes in forth, turns round with the number six, and then closes a zone, which is about visible. And because it's enclosed, the energy inside beats about like this inside. It draws innumerable mug and dubbins and various symbols, and it goes dark. And the darkness there is a special kind of darkness, the darkness of ideas. When you think, you actually THNK. That is, you crucify power in a closure. THNK. Crucify power in the closure. So there are two kinds of darkness. One is the darkness of the necessarily undefinable will, and the other is the darkness of the idea, which makes you think you know something, but what you know is an idea, not the will. There are many scriptures that say there is darkness and there is gross darkness. Also, there are many commentaries that say about the darkness, there is a darkness of people that know nothing, and there is a greater darkness of people that know something. Because those who know something are trapped by their ideas into thinking that they know something about the causes of events. Suppose we were to take modern empirical science. It's pursuing power. It's going to investigate all the planets and all the spaces between, and it's going to go outside, beyond the solar system, into space. And it's going to make space platforms, and everywhere it goes, it's going to have another idea, another invention, and it will spread itself through space with lots and lots of space platforms, with cities built on them, and people, and they'll all be at war and shooting each other, like in best science fiction. And it'll be full of ideas, but the one thing it will not have discovered by those ideas is the will, the primordial motivation that determines them to do so. Now, this dark part is below the diaphragm and means the impulse not examined, the dark impulse that moves you to act without thinking, without sensitivity. I'm going to write by Ham. I put H-M. I'll put, for the sake of our little friend in the front row, H-A-M. Ham. Ham means hot, black, dark impulse. One of the sons of Noah. But in the upper part, which is above the diaphragm here, it splits into two lungs, and one of them has a positive charge and one a negative charge. You have two feelings, liking and disliking. And I'm going to put the name Shem on there. That's another son of Noah. Shem means that sensitivity of feeling, of like and dislike, that allows you to name a thing as likable or not likable. Ham doesn't bother to do that. Ham impulsively moves towards its objective. Now, out of the middle, there arises from the conflict point of the dark will and the intellect, bringing up at right angles to them, there arises another power, and that power is called Yafet, or Japhet as the same English. Now, just as Ham means hot, black, impulse, unconsidered, and Shem means the power of naming by liking, disliking, Yafet means enlargement of vocabulary through analysis. It is Yafet. I'm going to say Yah in primordial, affirmative action, and the PH is one letter, a phi, a pei in the Hebrew, and the T in the phonetic E. To affirm analytical life crucifixion in the head. Now you know that Christ is said to be crucified in Golgotha. Golgotha means place of the skull. And we've drawn a three-part human being with a diaphragm here, an impulsive dark will below it, and an intellective affective thing which judges by fine sensitive feelings, like a good Jewish violinist, like a Heifetz. And then the man who actually affirms logical chopping. Historically, he's the Caucasian Greek. He's a Hellenic who affirms logic chopping as a means of furthering, of extending vocabulary. It's significant that in the Semitic languages you don't use vowels, but when the Greeks borrowed that language, they put vowels into the language to fix the meaning of the word. The word in the Hebrew, without the vowels, could mean several different things. But if you put the vowel in, it becomes then fixed in meaning. And the Greeks loved to fix the meaning. The Greeks, we say, had a word for it. They were very proud of having a word for it. So they fixed it. So we have three functions. A dark belly urge, a feeling of like and dislike, and an intellective fixation on the ideas. Now we'll draw the same thing again. A three-part man, belly, chest, head, like that. Now we're going to remember and shade this one dark. That's Ham. And we're going to put a plus, I like it, negative, I don't like it there. And we're going to put the sign of Logos, lambda, gamma, in the head. Logic. And then we're going to say this. We're going to take the same symbolism of the three and put it here. And we're going to put go down there. Go means primordial, non-analyzed will. You see it in the name of the gull, the seagull. Gull means appetite. Go means appetite. And that gull is the dark will. Observe, it's the reverse of log, which is reason. In other words, it's an anti-reason. It's against reason. Reason interferes with it. And that same gull inverts itself and crucifies itself and climbs up the spinal cord and becomes God. I've had an extra T on there for fun. I get God, which is Germanic for God. The idea of getting the gull, the appetite, to climb up the spine and locate in the head is to become powerful like God. So we've got go, primary appetite, inverting into intellect to find and try to possess power through intellective activities. And then the same power, when it's climbed up, turns down and goes into the middle, and there in the middle it is ha. H-A-R-J there, is the laughter of acquired power. In Nietzschean terms, the only legitimate laughter is the laughter of acquired power, all else is hysteria. Golgotha. This is called the place of the skull. Why? Because in the skull, in the brain, we have total representation of all our functions. So I'm now going to draw brain like that. I'll put a nose on it for fun. I'm going to cap this brain into three zones like that. And at the back I'm going to shade it. That's dark will. Forward there, that's the goal. I'm going to put the mark of crucifixion on form. And in the middle, I'm going to write ha. The link factor, the emotive power, which is in the center of the brain, that links together the unconscious, dark, compulsive will, which is formers, with the well-informed, intellectualized, analyzed, ideological structure. This how means that there is a way of balancing the power of your will with the refinements of your intellect. You know the plumber's bill, washer putting in tap, £5, itemized washer, fourpence, the rest is knowing how to put it in. The intellect knows how to handle the power. To striking with the hammer, fourpence, to knowing how and where to strike, £5. Now, the last of acquired power means you've got power, which is your unconscious, unformulated will, and when your intellect is developed and permeates that power, then you have, with the power, know-how. And when you have both, then you say, ha! Exclamation mark. An exclamation mark is a bit like a letter I, with the dot at the bottom instead of the top. It means, out of a point of meditation springs up a startlement. Hidden in the point was an amazing secret. The point of individuation, which is the point where the will and the feeling meet there, which elevates itself to produce an intellectual analysis of the intellect itself, the aesthetic evaluation of the idea, and the feeling sensitivity of the unconscious former's will. Now, when we get a primitive word, they were built, many of them with three letters, some with two, but many of them with three, to express certain concepts. So I'm going to write down a word of a Persian hero god, Mithras, like that, and then I'm going to take the middle letter like that and polarize it out towards Ras and towards Tim. We read this word from the center both ways. Now Tim means fear and time. The only reason we pursue things in time is because we fear their loss. The word timid means time form. Part of that H, which means power, polarizes towards fear, and part of it polarizes towards ruling active self. Thus means a prince or ruler. So there are two kinds of people there, boss-type people and timid people. And the rule of the boss-type was, if someone is afraid, kick him and jump on him and increase his fear and then tell him to chop the wood. And that was a very ancient rule, well tried by all the governments of the world, and it still has a utility function in the modern world. If they're frightened, terrify them. If they're not, diplomatize with them. Now, in the middle, I'm going to write the archaic word for priest, hieros. Now, that is the word for priest. The function of the priest in the ancient world was to balance the boss types and the timid people, because the boss types were always killing people to demonstrate that they were bosses. You know, even in samurai techniques of dealing with people. In the Middle Ages, if a person didn't immediately bow down, his head was literally cut off. In the presence of the other villagers, one head rolled and the others immediately cut out. The ruling ones intimidated those who could be intimidated simply by killing one or two in public. Now, this often caused shortage of water drawers and wood choppers. So the priest intelligently said to the ruling types, don't kill too many workers, otherwise we shall have to go to work. Remember what Socrates said, if we hadn't got hewers of wood and drawers of water, we would not have time to think about philosophy. The hieros is the man that knows that ruling activity can produce reactions like the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and other revolutions of trade unions today. And it would be better to curb the rulers when they become excessive, and to strengthen the courage of the timid by telling them that above them there is a power. I've done an inverted letter, which is a Hebrew letter, shin. A power that is threefold. It's a ruling power, and it's a power that goes into the timid and can lift them up so they become on the level with the rulers. And the one who knows this triple power was called the priest, the hieros. Now, when we look at hieros, it is H, which means hierarchy of power. It is I, which means the individual. And it is eros, which means love. This erotic principle in the ancient world was known to be more efficacious by the hieros. And the hierarchic rule was, don't beat the people so hard that they can't build the pyramid. And don't allow the rulers to get out of hand by thinking that they are superior to cosmic law. If we then apply this Mithraic principle to another word, this word, angst, is the German form of the English word anxiety, and it's polarized by the middle letter G going to right and left, and on the left side it is a running serpent, and on the right side it is a crucified serpent, and the G there means God. God polarizes towards Anna, the running serpent, and Star, the crucified serpent. The Anna runs and never fixates itself, and it's a pleasure pursuing. An energy that pursues pleasure and doesn't like being nailed down on the results of pleasure. It's like a pleasure that runs about impregnating ladies and not paying the bill for the baby club. And on the other side, there is the same serpent caught and crucified and made to pay the price. And again it says that God, that is the all power of reality, polarizes into pleasure and responsibility. Now these polarizations occur in all languages under various symbols. When we recognize the reality is we are power zoned or encapsulated within a universal field of intelligent power, and that universal field has itself never lost control of its own modalities. I should now cool myself a little. Never lost control of its own modalities. Nor can it be conceived to do so, because the modalities are nothing but the behavior of that field. And this is why it is said God is not mocked. Nobody making fun of God, because the energy with which you make fun is his. And if you make fun and he allows it, he's not bothered with what he allows. The universal field of power won the victory over creatures before the creation, because the universal power is partless. It cannot be parted, cannot be destroyed. But a being that is encapsulated can be broken down, can be attacked finitely, can be disintegrated. So the power of the absolute continuum is there eternally and cannot be defeated. Now, when we utter the letter M, we have to close our lips to do it. We have to go M. We can't make an M without closing the lips. And this letter M therefore symbolizes closure, and in the closure, darkness, and in the darkness, nescience, that is not knowingness, loss of light. And that M, the Hebrew mem, signifies water as plastic substance. M remembers that once it was free, when it was called R or Aleph or Alpha, free, but when it closed its lips to grab at the infinite, in grasping it went, it uttered the word I am. In the very moment of grasping its identity, it closed. You see what happens if you are a free spirit and you're going along like a basking shark, lots of plankton in the infinite ocean, and your mouth is wide open, and you're filtering it out, and your jaws are open, and the supply of plankton is infinite, that's fine. But supposing you decide you're going to have a mouthful and keep it, so you shut your mouth, and you keep swimming, but now your mouth is closed. Can you get any fresh plankton? No, not with a closed mouth. The letter M symbolizes the closed mouth, but it remembers that once it was open, because all power, all energy is sentient and feels its own condition and remembers its previous condition. So the M is the basis of memory, the retention of the form of experience. So then we have an egoic closed substance which remembers once upon a time it was free, and instead of opening its mouth, it keeps its mouth closed and then tries to become free. So it's going about uttering the magic mantra mmm, which in yoga is reversed into om, the magical om, which splits into R-U-M, which means waking, dreaming, sleeping. Again, the three parts of the human being, It is going along there, egoically closed, and hoping to get infinite power into its finite closure. It wants to keep its self-encapsulated, egotistic self-will, and yet mysteriously gallop up, swallow all the infinite free spirit there is, and use it for its own finite closed purposes. Now this is manifestly illogical. But this appetival substance, which is called M-R, substantial activity equals appetite, Ma principle, the mother principle, appetite, because it remembers once it was free, once it was omnipotent, once it was in delight, once it was in sensuous, free, unimpeded enjoyment, swimming to infinity, and now it is closed. And the memory of this is the source, cause of what we call today evolution. Evolution is the attempt to get hold of infinite power without letting go of our finite organism. And what kind of opportunity is there for a finite being with a finite stomach and a closed mouth to attain infinite free spirit and then keep it for itself and deprive other beings of it? Because what we observe in time amongst the timid is that they pursue power in order to use power over other beings. They want to gain power, write their name on it, put it in a parcel, swallow it, not give it away. And then the only time they will open their mouth again is if they see another bit of power going by, and they will open it and grab and then shut the mouth again. Evolution in the universe is nothing but an attempt to regain a lost pre-state of omnipotent, free, delightful motion of spirit. And it's a movement that's found only in closed substances. As long as you identify yourself as a finite being, limited, inside the skin, and think it's your duty to open your mouth to eat, to get the energy, to get the power, to boss other people about and deprive them of power, as long as you do that, you cannot get the infinite power that you seek. It's a dialectical impossibility. When you see that and you say, let's look at this relation, Ma and Pa. Ma is the appetite, and Pa is the positive, precise affection that arises from the appetite in a process of self-refining, increasing definitional power. The Ma principle becomes the Pa principle. Now you know that every little boy in the womb was once a little girl. You know that the male genital organs are not there in the embryo in the early stages, where all we boys are little girls to begin with before birth, and we have quite a problem sewing up our vulnerability and extending our little clitoral finger, clitoris meaning key to the law, extending it into a nice aggressive member, and we tend to forget once we were little girls, and we tend to lose sympathy with the others who didn't make what we got, a magical appendage. When we recognize that the only thing that carried us from Ma to Pa was a committal to precision, the M became P. Now they're both labials, they're both made on the lips. Ma becomes Pa at the precise point when we decide to act upon principle. Principle means reason, means logic of form. when we decide to get form, as we get the form, we become progressively less vulnerable and less femininely determined and more masculine. Now, a lot of women are terrified of masculinization because they think it means beards and mustaches and undesirability. So they try to resist the input of logic into them, because they can feel the logic means crucifixion on the idea. But the ones that convert into males commit themselves to ever more logic, and the logic becomes a formal weapon of trying to control the will of a non-formulated other being. Now, this ma-pa relation develops itself spontaneously because the appetite, going about in time and matter, cannot help encountering stimulus situations. It meets events, it strikes against obstacles, and it suffers pain. It means contraction. Instead of going about with the open mouth swallowing, when you get a pain, you shut the mouth for the time being, and that M becomes P. The more M-A-W becomes poor, a more precise weapon. When that weapon becomes dominant, then the person who has committed himself to form, if he's not careful, will tend to think that by formal manipulations he can control the will. But we've said that the will is not intellectually formulable. So the P can never control the M. The Pa cannot dominate the Ma. You can try by the application of ideas, but the Ma, the mother principle in the marriage, is not actually conditioned, because she cannot be conditioned unless she herself conditions herself by accepting and affirming the idea represented by the letter P. That letter P in English, in the Hebrew, is a pei, which is a drawing of a mouth, and it means speech. It means the power of precise formulation. Now imagine when you're thinking, you can think woolly-headedly and get very, very confused, or you can think very precisely and then you're not confused. Confused means fusing together things that would be better kept apart. Now, every form that is different, like a triangle, a square, a circle, and so on, if the forms are different, it is better to keep them apart so that you can see them differently. Because if you don't see them differently, then you will become confused. If you were to draw on the same piece of paper all the shapes that you know of, one on top of the other, and then look at it, you would be looking at confusion. Now, a human mind can actually become confused in that way, by having non-precise ideas not kept separate. Now, when we have ideas that are not separated out according to their categories, their formal differences, those ideas, they're not nothing, they're energies. There are no non-energies in the whole universe. Now, imagine your being is energy. It isn't anything else. Every particle of matter is energy. Every particle of food you eat in order to break it down, digest it, turn it into energy and use it. But imagine that these energies all are sentient. They feel themselves, and they have their own directives, their own opinions, and they fight their own battles in their own way. So if you've got an idea of a triangle and an idea of a square, those are ideas or forms of energy which will quarrel in your mind if you try to put them together when they should be separate. Let's see an analogy for music. If we take a note, say the tonic, and then the third, and the fifth, and the octave, and strike a chord, we say, oh, that's harmonious. But if we strike two notes too close together, say like C and C sharp, we get what we call a discord, because those sounds are energies, and if they're too near, they quarrel. But if we allow them sufficient space between them, like C to E, then they're harmonious. Harmony means free allowance between beings. If individual human beings recognize that relationships imply allowing the other being free space to be in, and not crowd them, not to encroach, but allow them to be what they are, and then adjust to what they are, rather than trying to crowd too close and thus producing a discord. The fight between C and C sharp on an instrument which produces a discord is identical at another level with the fight where one individual tries to make another individual change form, change character, in order to harmonize. What you get is discord. It's in the interspace where the harmony is possible. Now let's look at this threefold band. Down in the tummy you throw your food, you work on it, and if you're lucky you digest it and convert it to energy. And the energy is sentient. That means if you eat a lettuce and digest it, the energy from the lettuce has got its own purpose as lettuce. If you throw something else, have you tried strawberries and pickled cucumbers together? Have you tried that? You can actually put foods into your stomach, which when they get there, fight. Do you believe it? Have you had that kind of experience? It's a very nice meal. It looks nice on the plates. It's very, very nice separately on all the plates. 42 plates. It's an Arab dinner, you see. And then you swallow them all. And when they get in your stomach, they say, what the hell are you doing here? And they literally start fighting chemically. Now you can either vomit, endure, or have diarrhea. Please yourself. Once the fight is on, it's going to go on until you do one of those three remedies. My favourite one for that is vomit. Or even better, don't eat the 42 plates simultaneously. One sheep's eyeball, one English radish, two chocolate meringue, one quarter ice cream, four strawberries, a banana, washed down with something celebration like champagne. You put it in and you wait not very long. Now the reason they fight is because they are real energies. Do you believe that food is a real energy? Do you believe that energy is sentient? Do you believe that it doesn't like other energies? Do you know what companion plants are? They're plants which you can grow together in the garden, and they're mutually helpful. And there are some that if you plant them together, they die. They don't like each other. Would you think some human beings are like that? You put two in bed together and they both fall out immediately. And if you tie them in, the bed sets on fire. Well, there are some at a very, very great distance. They can actually drift through the ether and lie in an etheric bed together with 10,000 miles between them. Do you believe it? Oh, it can happen. You are where your treasure is. Where the heart is, there is the treasure also. Now, your heart symbolizes your feeling capacity. Your feeling is the field force of the universe in the place where you are. When you feel, what you're feeling is the behavior of energy within your organism, or within any place you care to put your feeling. So you can feel close to somebody a million miles away, or you can feel alienated with the person next to you. Have you had that experience? You're in my arms, said the pop song, but a million miles away. Can happen. On the other hand, a pair of eyeballs strike across the crowded room. You can even read the scowl of those eyeballs if you don't watch them. Best thing to do when you feel it happening is shut the eyes, because you need your eyeballs for work tomorrow. When you recognize that total reality is nothing but a field of sentient power, power that feels itself and it operates wherever it imagines itself to be. Now the word imagine means I make. The marg in that is ma, that is appetival activity, plus gamma, that is condensation. The I is individuated. Image means an individuated appetival self-condensation. Imagination means the power to set up a form inside your field of consciousness and so charge that form that it becomes operative, like a three-dimensional being. And you could posit it anywhere, whatever. You could put it in an Eskimo's igloo and it would melt. Or you could go and sit on the equator and freeze. All depends on the power of your imagination. Your imagination is creative power. And if you knew how powerful it was, you'd be very careful with it. Because you transmit whatever is not in the intellect through space by the magical power of the will. Now the magic is in the will, not the intellect. We have a three-part being, a trinity, a three-in-one. That three-in-one is a power to feel, to mobilize feeling, and to formulate. We feel, we mobilize, we formulate. That's a triple power that we all have. Now when we formulate it in the idea, the formulation is fixated by the definition and it can't get out of its defined limits, so it's not magical. All definition inhibits formal dispersal. It won't allow an idea to radiate if you have a clear idea in consciousness. But if you have the will to push it, it is the will that can push it, not the intellect. The will can magicize, appetivalize, magnetize. So it's a thing that you imagine with full consciousness of will can become a living, vital determinant of life in the individual and in the nation and in the human race as a whole, and it can actually affect universal energies throughout all space. So that when you control your will and set up a volitional form, not limited by an intellectual definition, that volitional power can produce changes and will produce changes if you don't disperse it by intellectual analytical procedures. Now how do we feel about this? We sit in our chairs and think, isn't it strange? There is an infinite field of sentient power and we, all of us without exception, are individuated zones of that power. It is that power that individuates as us. Our organisms are just that power pretending to be organisms, rationally tending to define themselves as organisms. And it is only our interest in organism that keeps organism in being. So if we lose interest in organism, we start losing organism. So if we lose interest in our own being, we start losing being. Would you believe you can lose weight through lack of interest? Would you believe you can put on weight by being interested in what you're eating? The whole problem of Weight Watchers is this. Do you eat with the image I'm getting fatter or do you eat with the image, I'm getting more intelligent? The image that you hold when you eat determines what's going to happen to your food. Now, we are talking about the subject matter of human being as self-evolving intelligent power. We live in a world where today we are being informed that we are in danger of being displaced by computers, by robots, so that eventually we would not need to exist. You can imagine a world of chip technology with imitation human beings electrically controlled. You can actually design a machine to make machines, to make machines, so that every time a machine breaks, another one takes its place. How would you like a universe of perfect robots, entirely determined by electromagnetic controls, and all the human race have vanished? How do you like it as a thought? Is it nice? Why not? Because you think you're superior to the robots. And you are superior to robots, because the robots are designed from outside by human intelligences. But the human beings are designed from inside by intelligent self-power. That's the difference. And therefore, if there were a universe full of robots all acting like human beings, but they weren't human beings, they were robots, they would have no freedom. They would simply obey their programming. And if the program has died, they would still go on obeying it. And if you had a robot electromagnetically controlled butler, and he came in at the appropriate time according to programming, and he gave you whatever you wanted to drink, and you went out again, and you died, and he still came in, and still went out, and still came in, and still went out, and you're busy there rotting in a chair. But he doesn't know. But in the case of the human being, because the human being is made from inside out, the opposite of the computer, the opposite of the robot. The human being is made from inside out by his own will. And do you believe that? Do you believe that what you are, including nose shape, eyebrows, lips, what you are is your design for you, according to your perception of reality? Do you believe it? It happens to be true. Now, supposing you don't believe it, then you must believe something else. And what else? The else is this. If you're not made from inside, you're made from outside. And if you're made from outside, you're a robot. Which do you prefer? To be a robot, made perfectly from outside, or to be a self-determining, self-creating, intelligent power operating from inside? I know my preference, what's yours? There was a lovely little book years ago called The Wisdom of the Beasts, and in it an eagle and a bullet were flying together through the air. And the bullet was scientific and said that it flew from point to point in space. And it gave an analysis of the mode of flight according to the theory of quanta of energy. And each point of space, a quantum of energy was expended. And the eagle said, I don't fly like that. I fly continuously. And the bullet said, no, 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 and gave its scientific argument. And while they were flying along, the energy in the bullet was running down, and eventually it landed on a ledge. And it was lying there on the ledge inertly, and the eagle alighted beside it and looked at it, and the conversation continued as before, the bullet explaining, my momentum has expended itself. I'm lying on the ledge because my energy imparted to me in the explosion in the gun has run out. So here I am on the ledge. And the eagle became impatient and kicked the bullet off the ledge. Which would you rather be, the bullet or the eagle? Now there are people, we call them empirical scientists, who are bullets. They actually like the idea that they're bullets. or their psychology is based on bulletry. Sometimes papal bulletry. There can actually be a definition, I am a machine, do not hold me responsible. If I kiss you, it's because I'm programmed by nature. If I rape my neighbor's darling wife, it's not my fault, I'm a programmed computer. So I'm not to be punished, am I? Because I'm a robot. Well, says the mechanistic society, yes, you are a robot, and so am I, so I'm putting you in jail. Now, this is a correct reply to any mechanist. On one occasion, a student was arguing with me and saying there's no such thing as free will. All things are conditioned, and he was a great behaviorist, and he was demonstrating free will doesn't exist. And I kicked him on the chin. He said, "You fool, what do you do that for? It hurt." And he hopped up and down, and I said, "I didn't do it. There is no free will, it is a reflex." Funnily enough, he didn't believe me. Now, that was very inconsistent to him. You see, if you're free, you can kick mechanistic behaviorists, and they have no ground of complaint. And when you meet them, do kick them, will you? Not reactively, but in the spirit of scientific demonstration. The human being is a god. Now it says in the Old Testament, this is God speaking, "I have said, ye are gods." Now let's define what a god is. A god is an absolutely self-determinant being. It's a being that feels, has power, and clarity of idea. It's a trinity. It is its own good. The word God and good are the same root. If you can do good to yourself, you are a god to you. But if you disintegrate through misapplication of ideas, you're a devil to you. Now, the God and a God differ in this manner. A God is inside the skin, and his authority is as far as his individuality is concerned. But the God is universal, is the original infinite power, which by its self-modalizing has produced this multitude of little gods inside it. And this universal power wills that the individual human beings shall be little gods, determining freely their own life. It's generous. It's a generating power. That's why it's generous. Infinitely generous. In its generosity, it says you can afford to make creatures who are free. Those beings are human beings. And each being that is free and self-determined is called a little god. But no god of the created order is permitted to dictate to another god of the created order, nor to the universal god. The universal god is in charge, and the little gods are in charge, each one of its own destiny, its own creative activity. But no finite human being as a little god is correct to try to determine the behavior of any other finite being. So the battle of human beings for power over each other is a fundamental error, because it can never succeed. Now, the center of any being is spirit, and the periphery is body, and the between land is mind. Spirit, mind, body. Draw a circle, name the periphery body, put a dot in the middle, call that initiative spirit, and the space between is mind. Now, the power at the center is superior to the power on the periphery. When you touch somebody's skin surface, tap somebody next to you with your hand, when you tap somebody like that, you have disturbed their periphery, but you have not determined their central initiative. Their interpretation of your touch is their business. You have no power whatever over the interpretation of your activity. You can touch the body, you can beat it, you can kill it, but you have no power over the center of initiative in that being. Nor can you ever get that power, because that center belongs to the infinite field power, that sentient power that we call God. And you can't get to the center. It's the most powerful power there is inside you. And the power comes from that center upwards and flows outwards through the middle zone to the periphery. And from the periphery, you cannot get enough energy to penetrate that center. So any attempt to influence a person from outside by stimulation of their peripheries, by stimulating their physicality, any attempt to do that is doomed to fail before we start. You can try seduction, that means calling out the middle part, the mind part, to cooperate with the external pleasure stimulus, but you cannot get that center to come off center. And if you do tempt it out with a nice tasty morsel of food, when it comes out, it hasn't left its center. The center is still the initiative center. The mind you can seduce, the spirit you cannot seduce. So when you finish seducing the mind and persuaded the body to react to suggestions of various kinds, the spirit inside can resent it, can send it back to you, and is not convinced. Even when the mind has accepted the stimulus, the spirit itself is not seduced. Now, this being so, we have to say our duty to ourselves, remember duty is the shadow of love, our duty to ourselves, the way we love ourselves, is to discover how to balance our three functions, feeling, willing, and thinking. Now, in God, because He's infinite, He has no problem. His will, His feeling, His idea are mutually interpenetrating. And they are simultaneous, instantly. But the human being has fallen through peripheral stimulation into separation, so that he feels one thing, wills another, and thinks another. Remember, that is our work, to put back together the severed feeling, will, and thought into a unity, just like they were before the fall into externalization. If we remember that work, then we've understood the real meaning of all religious systems, all yogas, all meditations. All point to the one thing, the reharmonization of the trinity of the human being.